Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, today I've got two great guests for you. The first one says that sobriety is the new black badge of honor in Hollywood. His name is Peter Roche, and he's an advertising guru and the author of a new novel called My Dead Friend Sarah, a novel. He says over 17.6 million adults in the U.S. are alcoholics, which means almost every family in the country is touched by alcohol addiction. And he wrote this new book. He took 6 months off, went down to Costa Rica with his wife, wrote this novel. And you'll have to wait and hear more about it. You'll have to stay tuned to hear more about it. But he said he could not have done that without sobriety. So interested to talk to him. And that's going to, he's coming up around 12:35 today. But first, I'm going to play you a tape that I sat down last week with an investigative reporter for the New York Times. His name is Charles Duhigg, and he's most recently been the lead writer for the New York Times front page series on Apple. He's a winner of the National Academies of Sciences, National Journalism, and George Polk Awards, and was part of a team of finalists for the 2009 Pulitzer Prize. He's also a frequent contributor to This American Life, NPR, PBS's NewsHour, and Frontline. And he's spoken to audiences as varied as MIT, the SC Johnson Company, and the Pasadena Art and Science Festival. So he's a very well-rounded guy here. And he's also a graduate of Harvard Business School and Yale College. And he went overseas as a news reporter a few years ago and learned a striking thing about the military. And that led to his book on The Power of Habit. Why we do and what we do in life and business. And we're going to bring that tape to you right now, and then I'll chat a little about it afterwards. Charles Duhigg. I want to just begin by looking at how you became fascinated by the science of habit in the first place. You say it was about a decade ago. You were overseas as a news reporter. Tell us about that and how you got involved.
I was in Iraq, and I had heard about this major down in Kufa, which is about an hour south of Baghdad, who was doing experiments to try and stop riots from happening. And he had found that the most successful way to do it was to remove food vendors from the plazas. And that basically what would happen is when crowds would gather to riot, they would get hungry, and if there wasn't anyone there to sell them kebabs, they would all go home. And I asked him how he knew that this would work, that the removing the food vendors would stop riots, and what he said was that the U.S. military is essentially this giant machine for changing habits, and that once you learn to recognize how habits work, you can sort of see that they not only occur within individuals' lives, but across groups and communities and societies and organizations. And that it's kind of like getting a pair of glasses that gives you x-ray vision into why people act automatically, and that it had changed his whole view of life. So I got really interested and came back to the U.S. and started researching it.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, I was fascinated to read that the general said that the most important thing he learned in the Army was understanding habits. It's all we talk about in command meetings, he said. And he even said that his wife and he write out habit plans for their marriage.
Absolutely, and for their kids. And I have to say, you know, I actually do the same thing. It's enormously powerful. Once you understand how habits work, you know how to change them. And in the last decade, we've learned an enormous amount from neurologists who have been studying habit formation. What we've learned is that every habit has three parts. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for automatic behaviors to start unfolding. And then the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward, which is how your brain learns to remember a pattern for the future. And for years, people focused on the behavior, right? Just what actually happened. But what we've learned in the last decade is it's the cues and the rewards that really shape habits. And that's how we can change and create new ones.
Yeah, so give us an example of how this works. And you had a great one with your cookie example, of course, because your wife was complaining you were getting a little pudgy around the middle there.
Exactly. I had this bad habit where I would go and I would eat a cookie every afternoon. And, you know, I feel like I'm a fairly successful person. And so it was really frustrating to me that I couldn't change this habit. I even put like a little post-it note on my computer monitor saying, no cookies today.
Which, of course, puts cookies in your mind, right?
Exactly. I somehow would ignore that every day. And so when I was talking to scientists, I would ask them, you know, how should I change this habit? And what they said is the first step is to diagnose the cue and the reward. So I focused on the cue first. I kind of took notes about each day when sort of this cookie urge struck. And what I found pretty quickly is that it always hit between about 3:15 and 3:45 in the afternoon. It was clearly a time of day that was the cue. And then I started working on the reward, because the rewards are really, really important in why habits function the way they do. And so I ran these experiments. Like, you know, I was trying to figure out, was it that I was hungry, and in which case, you know, sort of just buying an apple, mm-hmm. eating that should suffice. Or was it that I wanted the burst of energy that the sugar gave me from the cookie, in which case having a coffee should do the trick. And I kind of went through a whole bunch of different ideas to try and figure out what the reward was, and I eventually figured out the reason I was going up to the cafeteria each day to get a cookie was because that's when I saw my colleagues from work. I'd basically socialize for like 15 or 20 minutes in the cafeteria. And the cookie had just become kind of this convenient excuse to give me a chance to talk to friends. And so once I figured that out, I could reprogram my behavior. And so now every day at about 3:30, I stand up and I look around, and I go find a colleague and walk over to their desk, and we gossip for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I go back to my desk, and the cookie urge is totally gone.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. It's made me look at my little habits and why I do what I do too. I'm starting to notice patterns there, you know, which is what it's all about, is being aware. Some habits, you say, have the power to start a chain reaction. And this is key, I think, for many people who feel, you know, they might feel overwhelmed or stuck or blocked or in a rut. So talk to us a little bit about what you mean by keystone habits and how that can change our whole life.
A keystone habit is one of these habits that when it starts shifting, it seems to set off a chain reaction that causes all types of other changes within someone's life. Keystone habits are essentially more important, the most important habits, because they seem to have this disproportionate power. A good example of this is, for instance, exercise. For a lot of people, exercise is a keystone habit, that when they start exercising habitually, they almost without trying start eating differently. Their eating habits change. And that makes sense, right? Because you're feeling healthy, you want to eat better. But what's interesting is that when people start exercising habitually, they also, on average, start using their credit cards less often.
Oh, that's interesting.
Doing their dishes earlier in the day and being more productive at work, often without even realizing that they're doing it. And that's because exercise is this keystone habit. So it sets off a chain reaction that causes other patterns within our life to change.
Right. I remember that you started the book with a story about a woman whose life was, quite frankly, a mess. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to be in that situation. She was decided to go to Egypt, and that kind of started turning things around for her. But she'd gone through a divorce, and she smoked heavily and ate too much. And tell us how she changed her life by just thinking that she had to stop smoking.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Her name is Lisa, and she had this really interesting story where her husband had come home and said he was in love with someone else. He wanted to get a divorce, and so she kind of freaks out and she goes to Egypt, and she's taking a taxi out to the pyramids, and she can sort of see the desert from the taxi, and she decides that she's going to come back and trek across the desert, and the only way that she can survive that is if she quits smoking, which actually, in retrospect, doesn't make any sense, because the way that you trek across the desert is in a car. Water, food. So you can throw in a pack of smokes. It's not going to make a big difference. But she becomes convinced that she has to give up smoking in order to survive crossing the desert. And so over the next year, she eventually goes back to Egypt and does it. Over the next year, she gives up smoking. And this kind of sets off this chain reaction. It was a keystone habit for her that, you know, she also starts running, and she eventually does a marathon, and she starts eating differently, and she loses a bunch of weight, and she gets a new job, and kind of her whole life changed. But if you ask her why, she'll say it's because she gave up cigarettes. And that's how keystone habits work, is that they tend to become the sort of this emotional focal point or fulcrum that the rest of our life shifts around.
Yeah.
Even if in retrospect, that one habit doesn't matter so much, it somehow starts this chain reaction that can echo through a person's entire life.
Yeah, and I think that's really key. And maybe that's why they call it a keystone habit, because we often think we've got to change, you know, I've got to stop drinking, I've got to stop eating, I've got to start exercising, instead of just focusing on that one habit, which ultimately leads to all these other changes.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So I'd like to look, if we can, because the book is split into three parts: how habits form, habits of successful companies, habits of societies. The habits of successful companies was was very eye-opening in many ways. I wanted to talk a bit, if we could, about Starbucks, because, of course, we're up here in Seattle where Starbucks started. What kind of habits have Starbucks continued that's helped toward their growth and success?
Well, Starbucks is really interesting because Howard Schultz in particular thinks a lot about the habits of his employees. Obviously, you know, training customers to buy a $4 cup of coffee every day is a habit in and of itself. But Starbucks, when they think about habits, it's not just habits among customers, it's also habits among their employees. One of the things that Starbucks noticed is that a lot of their employees, particularly, you know, recent high school graduates or people for whom working for Starbucks was their first job, that they needed to learn these life skills that older employees already had, most particularly the willpower to make it through an 8-hour shift while also delivering this high level of customer service. And so Starbucks developed a curriculum for training its employees that's built around giving them willpower habits. One of these is actually called the latte method, and it's very explicit that basically there's a cue there that when a customer comes in and they're unhappy, that's the cue. That the routine is you use the latte method, which is that you listen to their complaint, you acknowledge their complaint, you take action to fix their complaint, you thank them, and you explain that this will never happen again. And the reward is that very often this solves the problem, right? I have a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. If I could teach my kids to use the latte method any time they dealt with someone who was unhappy, I think it would really revolutionize their life.
I would agree.
Yeah, what's really happening there is that Starbucks is taking willpower and turning it into habits and giving people these kind of algorithms to follow when you encounter a tough life moment. And if you talk to Howard Schultz, as I did, he'll tell you that this is one of the reasons why the company is so successful, is they've learned how to make customer service, how to make willpower into a habit, and they've trained and given that to their employees.
Right, right. It's fascinating stuff. And one thing that I took away from this, you know, I've talked about habits before, and I've heard this before too, but I didn't realize that the basal ganglia, which is part of the brain, actually stores our habits. So even when we think we've broken a habit, we never truly have. Explain why.
That's exactly right. So when a habitual behavior emerges, it's creating a neural pathway. And that neural pathway will be there for the rest of your life. So the key to breaking a habit isn't to ignore it or to pretend like it doesn't exist or try and stamp it out. It's to change the habit, because no matter how much you kind of like try and force it down, that neural pathway is always going to be there. But if you change the behavior associated with those cues and rewards, then you're changing the neural pathway and you're making a new behavior more likely. So one of the lessons that the book talks about, and it tries to use stories to explain this, is don't just try and ignore or overpower a habit. Instead, diagnose the cues and the rewards and try and change it. And we know from studies that's much more likely to be successful.
Right. And as you said, you do use a lot of stories in the book, which really helps to illustrate. I wonder if you'd, you mentioned earlier that you use this at home yourself, the writing marriage habits and with your kids. How have you applied this with your children?
We spend a lot of time talking about cues and rewards. So my 4-year-old, you know, like, take dessert time. He loves desserts. And so we talk about, you know, how are we going to create good dessert and good eating habits, and what are the cues when you want dessert or when you feel like you're getting out of control? You know, what are the cues that let you know that you're getting out of control, and what routine do you want to use? We actually have these three steps. He step one is take a deep breath. Step two is blow it out. And step three is say, I am getting calm now. It's like, it sounds super hokey, but then you see this four-year-old who, like, is about to, like, explode because he can't get some toy, and he goes, step one, and he takes a deep breath and goes through it. And it's really, I mean, you know, the thing is that all of this stuff is based on these neurological studies that have been done recently that really have revolutionized our understanding of habit formation. And it's powerful stuff. It's really nice to see it in action that way.
Yeah, well, it truly is, I said at the beginning of the show, a fascinating book, The Power of Habit. What surprised you most? I know we're almost at the end of our segment, but what surprised you the most when you were researching this book?
I think what surprised me the most is how malleable habits are. I mean, one of the things that scientists have learned and researchers have learned is that any habit can be changed. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter how ingrained the behavior is. Any habit can be changed. If you can diagnose the cues and rewards, you can make these shifts.
Well, I'm going to be applying some of those once I figured out why I do what I do. Fascinating read. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Charles?
If anyone has any thoughts, I'd love to hear from you. My website is thepowerofhabit.com, and please don't hesitate to be in touch.
Yeah, and there's a good blog up there and a video explaining the cookie habit again. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. And that was a taped interview that I did last week with Charles Duhigg, investigative reporter from the New York Times. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. And I'm going to share with you a couple more points from that book, which I think you might find interesting. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
I'm addicted to you, babe. You're a hard habit to break.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Who is Chopra?
What is Chopra?
When is Chopra?
Joe Janeau is the host of a brand new show called Chopra. Joe has been nicknamed Chopra by his friends and colleagues who find his advice and insight to be enlightening, just like a certain other talk show host of world renown. Born and raised in Seattle, independent-minded Joe Janeau is bringing issues to the airwaves that make you ponder, laugh, and deliberate. The Chopra Show is about the ins and outs of food and drink, relationships, entertainment, and so much more. Get to know Chopra every Thursday at 2, right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Coming soon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. When Karen Brown landed in Seattle with her husband and young baby, she made it her mission to discover her passion. Join Vicki on August 20th as local personality Karen Brown, a.k.a. the Frantic Foodie, shares her journey to becoming a favorite Northwest food entrepreneur and the author of The Food Lover's Guide to Seattle. See conversationslive.net for guest schedules and podcasts of previous shows.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we just heard from Charles Duhigg, author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. And, you know, in all honesty, I'd recommend everyone read this book. I think we've all got habits we want to change. But one of the most significant things, I think, was that the guy that in the beginning of the book that he talked with, a major in the military over in, was it Iraq or Iran? Iraq, I guess it would have been. He... said to Charles Duhigg that the most important thing that he'd learned in the military was learning and understanding people's habits. And so, you know, you couldn't help but get intrigued in the book from there. And it's broken up into three parts: how habits form, habits of successful companies, and habits of societies. And I just wanted to touch a little bit on the habits of successful companies, because I work in marketing and marketing communications and PR and branding, brand awareness. But I was still surprised to the depth of which companies track shopping habits. And I wanted to bring Eric in here a little, because I know that one of his favorite stores to shop at when they're having a clearance sale is where?
Target.
I
like bargains. What can I say? They've got lots of bargains.
Well, I shop a lot at Target too, and they'll be glad to hear that, because that's what they want.
Exactly. Yeah.
They're trying to make themselves a one-stop shop. And, you know, I should say that, of course, we're talking about Target here, but all companies do this. Amazon, yeah. Procter & Gamble. I mean, you know, all companies out there are doing this. There's no real secret there, but I still was a little shaken at the depth to which they're going.
It sounds like, from what I've seen and heard, that Target really has it down to a science that other companies are now starting to emulate. That Target is really on target, I guess.
Yes.
To put it one way, as far as tracking people's shopping habits and, you know, trying to use that information to mold those shopping habits.
Yeah, and it's called predictive analysis, and what they're doing is looking at your shopping habits. And how do they do that? They give every single customer a unique identifier code. Now, I'm sure they can't do that if you pay with cash, unless they say, you know, tall lady with blonde hair.
Right, right. That's a good point.
But they do give everybody a unique identifier number. And then eventually, all of course, your credit cards and debit cards and all that stuff gets tied to that unique identifier number. And then they know exactly what you want. And there were a couple of stories that were kind of shocking. I think one made the national news one night. And I think it's probably when Charles' book came out. And that was how Target knows what you want before you know you want it. And there's a lot of controversy around this, because they're saying, you know, if a woman is pregnant and hasn't told anyone, should Target really be telling everyone by sending her prenatal and postnatal stuff, coupons in the mail, which is what they were doing to a young girl, and her father found the mailings that Target had sent to her and was very upset because she was a teenager. And he contacted Target and said, why are you sending my young child these coupons for baby stuff? What are you thinking? Well, then a little while later, he contacted them again to apologize, because she was indeed pregnant. And I don't know the full details of that, but one might guess that maybe she brought a pregnancy test there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing led to another.
You know, I've actually heard, because I've heard this a little bit about this story, that Target finds out that figured out that if women start buying vitamins, when they hadn't bought vitamins before, and especially like folic acid, that sort of thing, then it's a good indication that a woman may be pregnant. And so
they can even tell to which trimester. Yeah. They can even break it down to which trimester
based
you're
on
in.
The purchases.
And target your coupons that are coming to your home.
Right.
based on that. I find that frightening myself.
It's a little bit Orwellian.
It's a lot Orwellian.
It's not, you know, a government doing this.
It's corporations.
Corporations.
Yeah, and it's happening a lot. But there were some really interesting stories in the book, you know, about Michael Phelps and Starbucks. And I think we talked a little bit about Starbucks and how they practice habits of success. There was a new CEO of Alcoa, one of the largest companies in America. And his first order of business was to attack a single pattern among his employees. He decided, I'm going to focus on how our employees approach worker safety. Now, their stocks were down, and of course the board of directors are thinking, oh boy, have we put the wrong guy in place here, because he's focusing on worker safety and our stocks are dribbling out the door. And but very soon, stockholder uneasiness about this plan turned around, because they saw an improvement in productivity, and of course the stock started going up. Hmm. So the way we look at habit, I mean, I totally changed the way I looked at habit after reading this book. I think it's a powerful book.
I think a lot of us probably have habits that we don't even realize that we have too.
Yes.
So it's a certain amount of self-analysis when it comes to habit changing, seems important.
Yeah, I think so too. One thing, you know, stick yourself in front of a video camera to watch body language, body habits and stuff like that. And you're thinking, why do I do that? But I found it a very interesting read. And if you want to find out more about Charles Duhigg, you can do so at charlesduhigg.com. And Duhigg is Duhigg.com. And he's written a lot of stuff on the Huffington Post. If you don't want to buy the book, but read some of his articles based on the book, you can find a lot about him on the Huffington Post and the Book of Gain, of
course.
Or
HuffPo, as I like to call it.
HuffPo. I try to respect the proper name there, since I'm in branding. it's a lot of good information.
So I suppose you don't call it Tarjay either.
Oh, I do. I'm going to pay cash now, though. Trust me.
I don't blame you.
And one of the ways that they track even more information about you, not just Target, again, but all companies, mm-hmm. is, you know, often they'll go and say, what's your zip code or what's your telephone number?
Right.
Well, I never give that information out.
Yeah.
I just say, no, I'm not going to give that. Thank you. But the reason they ask for that, and some people have said to me, oh, we just want it to see where our customers are coming from.
Right.
The reason they want it is so that they can track it to your credit card and to your mailing address. And then, you know, all the other good stuff comes with it, too. So think twice about giving that information out. Anyway, Charles Duhigg's book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. And coming up next, we're going to be talking with Peter Roche, who spent 15 years in the New York advertising industry. In fact, he still is in there. But he's now also the author of My Dead Friend Sarah, a novel. And we'll be talking with him in just a few minutes. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We are talking now with Peter Roche. He is the writer and creative force behind numerous ad campaigns, including Levi's, Miller Brewing, and the new critically acclaimed Fear No Susan Glenn Axe commercial. When he's not writing ads, he's educating fans via his blog, level9paranoia.com. He's outlining ideas for books and films or performing his as his alter ego, Joey Jojo. We're going to have to find more about this. Joey Jojo in New York City's most prolific rock band, The Future. You'll find him playing fetch with his cat. This is ironic, called Target, since we're just talking about Target. And welcome to the show, Peter Roche.
Thank you very much, Vicky. I'm really thrilled to be on with you.
And I want to say your new novel is called, your first novel is called My Dead Friend, a novel by Peter Roche. My Dead Friend Sarah.
No worries.
So congratulations on that, because I know that was something you'd thought about for many years. But I want to start off a little with a little of your background, because that's interesting to me. And it kind of follows on from Charles Duhigg's, you know, what we were just talking about with corporations collecting information and selling to us. You're on the other side of things, because you're creating the ads that, that encourage us to go out and buy these things. And you've been doing this for a long time. How did you get into the industry and why?
Well, you know, after about 2 years of going in and out of many majors, at the University of Texas in Austin, this was back in 91, 92, 93, it became obvious that I had no idea what I was doing. And I actually sat down to have a beer, of all things, ironically, with a good friend of mine who said if I decided not to quit school, I should really give an introduction to advertising a shot. And, you know, my mom and my dad and some other people made it pretty... made an impassioned plea for me to finish up school, so I thought, okay, I'll stick it out and I'll give it a try, and I kind of fell in love with it, and almost immediately, and I was able to get through in about 2 years, and it's a very good program that they had then and still now, and I think it was about 3 or 4 months after I graduated that I moved up to New York City, and I've been up here ever since, with the exception of the 6 months in Costa Rica.
And so you've been a, and I know you've won awards for this, for your work. You've been a creative writer, a creative director, an art director. Tell us a little bit about what's involved in those roles.
I think ultimately all the roles serve for the same purpose, which is to bring to life big ideas for brands or, you know, a specific product or services. So ultimately, no matter which part of the machine you are, you're hoping to, you know, bring messaging to the populace that really strikes a chord with them. So as a writer, often, you know, it's the exact words that I'm working on along with a partner who's usually an art director. And we work together to kind of craft an idea that people will find interesting, but also hopefully relevant. You know, I was actually just writing a post this morning for a publication about how often, you know, even I'm lied to, you know, and I don't think anybody likes to be lied to. So we try to do everything based in truth and do it in a creative way. And hopefully that's when we make the big bucks.
Right. It's a high pressure industry, because I touch on that in my work as a marketing and communications consultant. And it's a very high pressure industry. I think a lot are, but it's always like, people want everything yesterday, and not yesterday even, but the day before, the week before. And I'm sure it's even worse in New York City. Is it? Do you think that's true?
You know, I mean, I would like to think that it's a little bit truer here. I think in general, the way that we are as a society right now is exactly how you just described. Everybody, you know, not only wants everything yesterday, but the minute that you give it to them, they just want what's, you know, what's next. And there's very little time to sit around and, you know, pat yourself on the back for your latest achievement. And some of that, I think, is built into, you know, the heads. I know specifically for me, that's sort of how I roll. Once I get done with something, I'm ready to move on to the next one. And
right.
At times it can seem a little daunting. There's no doubt about that.
Right. Of course, Mad Men, the series, is a huge series, and Don Draper, the lead character there, you've been kind of compared to him in publicity campaigns. But of course, that was in what we think of as the heyday, when they had those long martini lunches and stuff. How has the industry changed over the last 10, 15 years?
Well, I mean, I think there's, you know, every couple of years, there's pretty significant changes. Probably the The most dramatic change has been the introduction of the different technologies that we use. I mean, you were just referencing all that stuff that Target does and other corporations do, and I would have loved to have been a part of that conversation. I mean, I think if you look at my blog, that fits right in with my paranoia, so...
Well, talk to us about that. You can be part of that conversation. I said my bit. You say your bit. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, there's. I think in anything that anybody does, advertising, banking, investing, mm-hmm. As we've seen, I mean, there's a fine line that exists for all of us in doing what's best for our clients, but also, trying to keep in mind the privacy of people and doing the right thing, morally. Ethically, and sometimes even as an advertiser, we try things, and people think that we've crossed the line. And what they have to understand is that when you're in a room with a bunch of other people, sometimes you're so close to a project you don't even see where the line is being crossed. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times, I think when people are freaking out and they're wondering how is it that somebody was able to get that out, or why would they put that particular commercial out, or that plan, or in that case the the whole thing with the prenatal vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, just like in anything else, sometimes we're just not thinking far enough down the road. We're so excited to get something out and see how it works.
Right.
And typically, if you're responsible, you're going to make adjustments as things play out.
Right. Well, we see a lot of ads. Yasmin is one I can think of, the birth control pill. They make claims, and then a few weeks later, Activia, the yogurt, is another one. They make claims, and then a few weeks later, they have to come on and make a blanket statement about, okay, we were wrong, we're changing the ad, and this is a new ad.
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's good to know that people are paying attention.
Yes.
That way, it does, things, adjustments are made, and I think for the most part, the people who are running corporations and brands and brand managers, they don't want to do anything that is, untrue or comes from a place that's just,
right.
Right. Not true.
I just think sometimes when we look at glossy magazines, this is the disconnect that I see a lot, and that's because I grew up with a family of hairdressers. My three generations had salons all over the place. And when I went to London on a course down there, we were doing a fashion shoot. It was my first fashion shoot. And I've always had very fine baby hair, and I always resented these girls who had big curly locks on front of magazine covers.
Yeah.
And then I find, okay, they put chicken wire at the back of that model's hair to make her hair poof out of the sides. Or they didn't really use those Carmen rollers. They used little tiny tongs. But I think, all stuff we need to be aware of.
That's true. It's true. And I think that some of the magazines that have taken a few chances having, actresses and models appear in their magazines without being retouched or, mm-hmm. Made very bold moves. And, ultimately, though, I think in anything related to entertainment, and I think the advertising industry is part of that establishment, we're going to be doing things that hopefully inspire people and that we're kind of selling dreams to some extent. And I don't think it's going to go away.
I don't think it is either.
Yeah.
Now, you're very honest about your struggle with alcoholism when you still are working in the industry. I know that. But how bad did it get for you? Do you think the kind of work you were in encouraged drinking? I mean, was it stress? Was it the lifestyle? Was it genetics?
I think that... while I was drinking, I probably would have pointed to about 50 different things that I could blame my drinking for. I've gotten to a point, in my life where I sort of believe I was born an alcoholic, and that the drinking itself was just a symptom of like a spiritual problem. But I definitely don't think, or I do think that a lot of those things exacerbated the situation. Whether it was coping with stress or dealing with disappointment or, there's very little, regardless of whether you're an alcoholic or not, that we don't use alcohol with. We celebrate with alcohol. Mm-hmm. We commiserate with alcohol. If we achieve something monumental, we, reward ourselves with alcohol. If we, and the reality is there's few ways that are quicker to unwind probably than cracking open a beer or having a glass of wine after work. So, what you learn in sobriety is that there are other ways, but you have to work very hard, you know, to do them. I don't think initially any of them are as easy as that immediate release. Of course, you know, what was working for me with alcohol stopped working probably 3 years, if not longer, before I, you know, admitted I was an alcoholic. And, mm-hmm. you know, the end for me found me unable to, you know, I had heard a guy once say that he had to drink to shower, and this was when I was, you know, considering the possibility that I might have a problem.
Wow.
That sounded foreign to me, but the reality is, at the end of my ride, I did need to drink to shower, and I couldn't do anything without drinking.
Wow.
And it found me, you know, sitting on my apartment floor, surrounded by just a ton of beer cans and cigarette butts, and I don't think I had eaten in probably a week or so, actually contemplating suicide. And fortunately, a friend of mine phoned right at that moment, and she lied to me and said that she was going to send a friend over, and the friend did come over, but the friend came over with an ambulance. And I think that was my fourth time to a hospital in about, you know, 18 months. But all four times, you know, even when I came out the fourth time and did go to rehab, I still wasn't convinced that I was an alcoholic. So denial is a very powerful weapon of the mind.
Yeah, they say, I've done a lot of interviews with neuroscientists and psychiatrists, and they all say that denial is the most powerful weapon out there.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, and in the business, you know, as I was struggling with drinking, certainly in the last 2 years, I mean, there's a lot of people who drink heavily, and I wouldn't say that they're alcoholics, and there's some people who drink moderately, and I certainly wouldn't say they're alcoholics, and I'm sure in any business, advertising or any, there's probably a lot of what you might call functioning alcoholics,
yeah.
Which I believe I was for many years. You know, it wasn't until I really, really stripped down everything. I didn't have any, you know, I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't have a job. I was kind of in between things, freelancing. And I took away every little thing that helped keep me in check that my drinking really accelerated. It most definitely would have reached a bottom eventually regardless. But that really helped me out. And I feel really fortunate that it happened when it did, because ever since then, my life's been, you know, pretty damn good.
Yeah, it sounds it. And you say that you'd never have written this novel without the gift of sobriety. So we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about your new novel, My Dead Friend Sarah. And please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Peter Roche.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Spread the word. Your favorite shows are on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Here's a fact you cannot rise above. We'll have problems, yeah, then we'll have bigger ones.
Welcome back, everyone. This is our last segment of Conversations Live today. My guest is Peter Roche, the writer and creative force behind numerous ad campaigns, award-winning campaigns, no less. He's been in a New York City ad agency for 15-plus years. He is the author of My Dead Friend Sarah, a novel. And Peter, in your original introduction a little while ago, I said, and I want to get this out before I forget, that we were going to find out more about you performing as your alter ego, Joey Jojo. So tell us what that is before I forget.
Well, I am a musician. I've been playing in bands most of my life. And the last band that I started that I'm currently in is actually called The Future. And as a part of that, I basically said to the guys, I really think we need to push it beyond just the music. We really need to do a show. It's very difficult to maintain any kind of fan base in New York City. There's so much to do, so much to see. People aren't just going to come because you have a good song. And I invented Joey Jojo, although the name does come from a certain show. But he is much, much darker than I think than that character was on that show. And in many ways, you know, Joey Jojo really was the embodiment of everything I was when I was drinking. He was not exactly a very nice guy. You know, some people might say he was sexy. It involves a wig, makeup, just full-on, you know, excess, I guess, is what I was trying to create with him. And for a while there, while I was drinking, it really allowed me to, you know, I guess, kind of hide who I really was by, you know, putting a face on it. And ultimately, there were times when that turned really ugly, too. I mean, some people refer to it as, I guess, your shadow self.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess that's what he is. Now, I still do him, but I'm happy to say he's a much nicer individual. you know, he wouldn't mind hanging out with him and having a conversation before a show. And that wasn't always the case, you know.
Right.
So he too, has sobered up.
Well, that's good to hear. And you certainly are involved in a lot of creative work. Let's talk about My Dead Friend Sarah, your new book. This is your novel.
Mm-hmm.
You had written, I read, a couple of novels or attempted to write a couple of novels before, but never really finished them or did anything with them. You decided to take 6 months off and go down to Costa Rica. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, the trip to Costa Rica, definitely writing a book was a part of that. There was also, I think at that time in my life, my wife and I just really wanted a break from New York City. We wanted to, you know, you reach a certain age and it makes it more and more difficult to do those types of things. But in the back of my head, writing the book was a big part of that decision. The other books that I had started to write, you know, I had quite some time ago before Mad Men, you know, even aired a single episode, I had thought about doing some sort of hybrid educational memoir about, you know, my journey from, you know, basically moving to New York City with $200 and then, you know, 10 years later being a senior vice president, executive creative director at a company. And I started that. And then when I went back to the drawing board after getting sober and I decided I was finally going to commit to completing a book, doing a memoir about, again, you know, my experiences in advertising, given it's what a hot topic it had become, seemed like the appropriate route to go. But two things happened, or three maybe. One, there's many, many, many memoirs about recovery from alcohol and drugs. Two, I was like, you know, who really wants to hear about me? And, you know, thirdly, I think by doing that, yeah, there would have been some amazing stories, no doubt, and maybe I'll write that at some point. But by doing a fictional version of it and basing it very closely to what I was going through in my head in my first year of recovery, I was actually able to explore all the directions that I might have taken. You know, my story ends very well, and I don't mind telling you that the ending in my book, My Dead Friend Sarah, is not exactly a pleasant one. And some people, you know, are not really into that. But for me, it was a way to create something that my hope was a lot of people could learn about addiction. They could learn about the thinking in addiction, and it can be quite monotonous.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of what's going on with you is all up in your head. And you know, that's why therapy and AA, so many of these things that we do are so important, because a lot of it is just getting outside of your head. There's an old saying, you know, my best thinking is what got me here in the first place, and I really believe that.
Right.
So
right.
In writing the book, I was able to sort of kind of show what could have happened, and that was really exciting for me. And, you know, I didn't really feel like writing a book that was just strictly based in the reality, as entertaining as that might have been. You know, maybe I will do that.
You do say that Max, who's the lead character, if you will, in the book, is a manifestation of how you see yourself at times.
Mm-hmm.
In what way?
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to say exactly how much of Max is me and how much of it might be me pulling in other personalities I met, you know, throughout my life or during that year as I was counting days with, you know, a lot of people who were in a similar situation as I was. But I think the thoughts that he has, you know, certainly I did not dream about a girl who was going to be abducted and possibly murdered.
We should explain what the story's about. We haven't done that yet. So it's about this guy who has a dream.
Yeah, he's a recovering alcoholic. He's got about 9 months, 10 months under his belt. He's doing pretty well. He's, you know, repaired things with his wife to a point, you know, where things are feeling pretty good. He's working again, and he's doing well. And then, you know, he had been dreaming about a woman for about 2 years, to the best of his recollection. You know, when you come off of drinking for years and years and years, and I mean really heavy drinking, it's difficult to say what is real, what wasn't, what did you dream, what was reality, what was a hallucination even. So he eventually sees that woman crossing the street, and he's just immediately struck with this feeling, like, that is the woman I've been dreaming about. And then, like many, many alcoholics and addicts, he decides it is his job to control the world and control that situation. And goes about the business of introducing himself to her, and it becomes a whole thing where he's trying to figure out how he can best befriend her so that he can warn her. And ultimately, she falls in love with him, and he makes a decision to stay with his wife and stay the course, and he cuts it off with her. And then not too long after that, she does, in fact, go missing. And then the police think that he might have had something to do with it, because earlier on he had actually gone to the police and said, you know, he had been having a dream, but it's right. In New York City, and I'm sure New York City police officers hear stuff like that all the time. So they blew him off until she goes missing. And then the story just sort of progresses from there. And you know, ultimately we see, you know, what addiction can do. And I think it's not just the addiction to the booze itself, but the addiction to control, the addiction to lies, the addiction to lying to yourself. You know, often, like, I'm very good at being honest with people. I have the most difficulty with being honest with myself.
Well, that's that I've heard many times from addicts and alcoholics. So I think you recognize that, and you come to a much better place now. We're almost right at the end of our segment, and I want to make sure we get your website in, Peter, which is...
Absolutely. My website is level9paranoia.com. And it is where I chronicle, you know, my thinking, imagined or unimagined, on almost anything.
There we go. And great writing, as we'd expect from somebody of your caliber. So you got some glowing reviews. Kirker's review said, Roche expertly explores the psychology of an alcoholic. The novel tackles sobriety, truth, and guilt, engrossing the reader in Max's whirlwind of problems while depicting the realizations of a recovering alcoholic. Roche skillfully renders a unique story of a missing woman. And you can find out more about that, again, Level 9 Paranoia, right?
That is correct.
Level9paranoia.com. Well, I want to thank each of you for being with us today. My guest there, of course, Peter Frosch, his book called My Dead Friend Sarah, and you can find that at Amazon in paperback and on Kindle. And we'll be back next week with an all-new live show. Looking forward to that. You can find us on Facebook. I just created a new page for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. So if you can find us on Facebook, Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and give us a like. You can track what's happening in between shows. And I guess that's where I'm at with that. I'm just thinking there's something else. Is there something else I have to give out today, Eric, or say? No? I'm just losing it here. All right.
I think wishing everybody a great week is...
Well, I'm going to do that. But I thought in my little head here, I had, okay, I was supposed to say something else before the end of the show. But that's cool. We're good to go. So you all have a great week. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us today. And you can find more about us at conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.